This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After losing in the presidential primary to John Kerry, Howard Dean has been working hard to get out the vote for his former rival. But Dean remains critical of how his party has responded to the Bush administration. He explains why in his new book, You Have the Power, How to Take Back Our Country and Restore Democracy in America. A little later, former Republican presidential candidate Pat Buchanan will explain why he's voting for President Bush, even though he's been critical of the Bush administration. Howard Dean served as governor of Vermont from 1991 to 2003. He's now honorary chairman of Democracy for America, an organization dedicated to building a grassroots network for the Democratic Party. You write that when you were running in the primary, that the Democrats said that you were dangerously far from the mainstream and your Democratic rivals had created a secret pack to go after you in Iowa, and they were spending $1 million running negative attack ads against you. You say this is the kind of tactic that Democrats and Republicans routinely use on each other, but I'd never seen Democrats doing it to one another, and I was furious. And then you say it made you wonder, why should you still be a Democrat after all this? So why are you?
Well, I think that in the long run, this has to be about the country, not about me. And as Al Gore told me in the part of the book that follows up on that story, this really is about the country. And there was no way that a third-party person could possibly win this election. All a third-party person was going to do on the Democratic Party side was to take votes away from John Kerry. George Bush is a national disaster, in my view. He's the least competent president we've had since Warren Harding. And he's an activist incompetent president, which makes him more dangerous. So I really wanted to do everything I could to make sure that John Kerry won. And, you know, as I got to know John Kerry after the primaries were over, I came to respect him. I think he's a bright, thoughtful person who understands the issues. He's inquisitive, and he marshals the evidence before he acts, and that's really important in a president.
Looking at the campaign now, are you surprised at the role the Vietnam War has played?
No. I think John Kerry made it a central issue because he wanted to describe who he was. And I think it has a lot to do with who he was. Actually, I think it has a lot to do with why I think he's going to win. All the time we were beating him, I kept thinking to myself, you know, this is a guy who served in combat in Vietnam. Where is that inner core that I know he has to have? How come he's not reaching it? And of course, he did in the end, and he did what he had to do, and he won. And that's why I think he's going to win in this one. When you go to combat and you serve in Vietnam, and I know a lot of people have done that, there is something different about you than the people who didn't go, like me. And you don't ever come back the same person that you did when you left. Nobody does. And there's something special about the people who went to Vietnam. And Kerry is one of those people, and he has a very deep core. It's part of his personality, even though he doesn't talk about it. He talks about it in a more political way, but it's there, and it's going to make a difference in the race.
What has your reaction been watching the Swift Boat campaign against Kerry? And now it looks like a movie by the group that mounted that Swift Boat campaign is going to be showing before the election on Sinclair broadcast stations.
Well, it's the repulsive side of American life. There's some people who aren't very good Americans. I'd say the people who run Sinclair aren't. I'd say the people who run the Swift Boat are doing this aren't. You know, negativism and kind of lying and using corporate influence, that's the unattractive part of American life, and that's what you got to overcome in order to have us be a strong country. If those people really continue to run the country, we're going to have a very weak country after a while. They can't possibly respect themselves at their core, and therefore other people won't respect them. And so that's one of the influences I'd like to see get out of the country. It's why I don't think corporations should have as much power in the media as they do, because you get people like that, or people like Rupert Murdoch with political agendas. They don't serve the country well, even though they serve their own ideology well.
Are you afraid at all that this election is so close that it will be contested in a way similar to the 2000 race?
I think it's likely. I mean, you know, the Republicans are already trying to suppress African-American votes. They're trying to suppress student votes.
What do you mean by that?
Making it difficult for students who have the right legally to register in college towns, making it difficult for them to do that. Secretaries of states, like the Secretary of State in Ohio, who came out with a ruling that said absentee ballots had to be, or provisional ballots had to be printed on 80-pound test paper. I mean, these are things that make it harder to vote, not easier to vote, and I don't think that's what we ought to be doing in a democracy. You know, then we have the problem of the touchscreen machines, which we know, even without malevolent intention, are not very good. There was a great story about Alameda County in Iowa, which, of course, I spent plenty of time in. There were 300 votes cast, and the machine tallied 4 million. And the problem is there's no way of going back and finding out what went wrong. All you can do is stare at the counter 6 times, and that's your recount. I mean, these are – so the problems in this election are far greater than they were in the last election because the technology has spread around the rest of the country, and it's bad technology, and it's technology fraught with huge problems. And I do think that unless there's a landslide one way or another, there's going to be huge problems.
Do you think the election will be as close as it's predicted to be now? Do you think the polls are accurate in registering a, you know, virtually neck-and-neck race?
Yeah, I think it's pretty neck-and-neck. I really do. And the reason I think so is actually good for us, for the Democrats. The people have already decided they prefer not to have George Bush reelected. In a year like this or in 1996, the first threshold is, do you want to rehire the guy you've already got? In 1996, Bill Clinton passed that test and Bob Dole never got in the race. This time, every poll, even the ones after the convention, Republican convention, when the president was doing well, every poll showed that the people thought that the country was going in the wrong direction. That means they'd like to give a pink slip to the chief executive. The threshold question then becomes, can John Kerry fill those shoes? And that is why it's close. A small number of people still haven't made up their mind yet. I think it's why John did so much better after the debates, when finally people could see in another direct candidate to voter exchange that he was capable of being president of the United States. And I think in a coin toss, the benefit goes to the challenger in a case like this. It's why the president's spending so much time on fear, on talking about terrorism and talking about gay marriage and all these kinds of things. Because he wants to try to scare those undecided people who know that he should not be rehired but haven't made up their mind about John Kerry. He's trying to scare them into his camp. I think in the end that's a losing strategy, and we're going to find that out in about 3 weeks.
But you say in your book that you were predisposed to like George W. Bush when he was elected president and that you expected him to be more moderate.
I did. And I don't dislike the president personally. I think he's a fine father. But he just has a penchant for not saying what the facts are to the American people. And he has an agenda that I'm horrified by. You cannot run up $500 billion deficits on a regular basis and expect to have good quality jobs and a standard of living in this country. You cannot send troops to Iraq without giving us a reason why that actually turns out to be true. You cannot denigrate and destroy the environmental legislation that he has done. You cannot give our taxpayers' money away to the biggest corporations in the country. This bill that passed this week is just an appalling example of that. It started out as a $6 billion trade adjustment bill, which was reasonable, and it ended up as a $145 billion giveaway to tobacco companies, oil companies, and so forth. That is ridiculous, and the Democrats voted for it. We got to get going and stand up for an America that's not dominated by corporations, but that actually serves ordinary Americans.
What impact do you think your presidential primary campaign had on the Democratic Party?
Well, it certainly energized enormous numbers of people, a lot of them young people, but a lot of them my age, who had given up on the process. I mean, we see a huge interest in this race. And it's, I think, partly because our campaign reached out to people and empowered them and made them understand that they really could have a role in changing America.
Well, what specifically do you think you did in your campaign that was different from the way other Democrats were behaving in terms of their criticisms of the president or their stand on the war?
Well, we went after the president right away. I mean, it's actually interesting. My view of politics is very similar to the Republicans' view of politics. You get your base out. You don't worry so much about the swing votes because they're going to come towards you when they see enthusiasm and a solid platform. You have to have a real policy that differentiates you from the other side. I think a lot of people in this country in the past have not voted because they couldn't tell the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, because a conscious choice on the Democrats' part was to be like the Republicans so nobody would notice there was too much of a difference and that somehow we would win that way. Well, I think that's a prescription for losing, and there's a lot of that in the book.
You write, the Democrats weren't standing up to President Bush. You write, Democrats were sweet-talked, they were bamboozled, and they were afraid. They thought that by accommodating the administration, they were somehow going to be okay. In doing so, they helped the Republican Party pass its far-right-wing agenda. Give me an example of what you mean there, about the Democrats being bamboozled or accommodating the administration.
Well, I get No Child Left Behind is a perfect example. The president put out this lovely titled bill with promises of lots of money for Title I schools. Even Ted Kennedy went along with that. But it turned out the president, as usual, did not keep his word, underfunded the bill by $23 billion. And it's a horrendous bureaucratic mess at the local school system, which has raised local taxes because it's an unfunded mandate. That's an example of being bamboozled and sweet-talked by a president who is not a truthful person. The tax bill was another one, $3.3 trillion ultimately in tax cuts. There, I think the Democrats were just afraid. They were afraid to stand up of their own voters. They didn't have enough faith in the voters. The voters understand that if you give tax cuts, that's nice, but our children end up paying the bill. And the Democrats just would not say, well, wait a minute now. First of all, a third of these tax cuts are going to people who make $1 million or more. Secondly, what about the budget deficits? We just got through balancing the budget when Bill Clinton was president. Now we have a $500 billion budget deficit every year. Wait a minute. We can't make that work. And nobody would say that. I think now, I think that we have affected the race because I think a lot of people now understand that the way to beat this president is to take him on, that his apparent strengths are really gross weaknesses. We're not safer than we were 2 years ago or 3 years ago. We're certainly a lot broker than we were, and our kids are going to pay the credit card bill for that. This is the borrow and spend administration that puts everything on a credit card. Somebody has to stand up and say that at some point.
You think that the Democrats drew the wrong lessons from President Clinton's success?
Well, I do.
If you would explain what you mean and then also apply it to the criticism that you've had of the party, of how they were too accommodating of President Bush.
Well, Bill Clinton has more political talent than we're going to see again in our generation. He more extraordinary, exceptional skills and charisma, more so than I think anybody in the White House since Franklin Roosevelt. Even Jack Kennedy had enormous charisma, but not the political skills of Bill Clinton. So this is a once-in-a-lifetime person. And much was made by the Democratic Leadership Council and other sort of Washington types that, Bill Clinton rescued the party because he moved to the middle. Well, Bill Clinton moved to the middle, but Bill Clinton didn't win because he moved to the middle. Bill Clinton won because he was Bill Clinton. He had an enormous amount of empathy at a time when we were going through a bad recession. He came up against a president who actually I thought was a decent president, George Bush Sr., but did not have the kind of political skills and was somewhat out of touch, and was held a little hostage by the own right wing of his own party. And so the Democrats in Washington made the mistake of thinking that the way you become president is to accommodate and move to the center instead of to stand up for what you believe in. Because Bill Clinton was, it didn't matter what Bill Clinton said, Bill Clinton was going to win that election because he was Bill Clinton and he had Bill Clinton's exceptional and extraordinary skills. That was the wrong lesson to learn from the Clinton presidency.
My guest is Howard Dean. He's written a new book called You Have the Power. It's a political critique based in part on his experiences running in the Democratic presidential primary. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Howard Dean, and he, by the way, has a new book called You Have the Power, How to Take Back Our Country and Restore Democracy in America. Did you feel that there was a lot of pressure in the primary or that there's a lot of pressure now for a candidate to discuss religion?
I think that's okay. I mean, I struggle with that a little bit. I struggled with that during the campaign. But, a lot of Americans really are deeply religious, and they do talk about it, which is unusual in my part of the country, in John Kerry's part of the country. But, I have a religious philosophy. John Kerry has a religious philosophy. And I think it's a little odd for us to talk about it from New England because we don't do that here. But I think it's fine to talk about it. But I hope that people who are used to talking about it every day in southern states and so forth will cut us a little slack as those of us from New England who have a different approach to religious matters and consider them to be very private.
Your state, Vermont, now has legal civil unions. So gay and lesbian couples can now have legal civil unions in Vermont.
Go ahead. Which means they have the same legal rights as anybody who's married. I think that, that was kind of a compromise between people who wanted to do marriage and people who didn't want to do anything at all, which were quite a large number of people in Vermont at the time. This was a breakthrough issue. And so the middle ground was everybody, as far as the state's concerned, the state doesn't pronounce judgment on who can get married or not, but the state does have to pronounce judgment on equal rights for everybody. So we found a way to give gay and lesbian couples the same rights as everybody else.
Do you think it's political suicide in the country right now for any politician to say, I support gay marriage?
I think it probably is if you're running for president. It may not be if you're running for Senate in Massachusetts. But I think that, you know, it's clear that an enormous number of Americans are deeply concerned about the issue of marriage. That is a very complicated issue. It's a complicated issue when we try to deal with the court decision in Vermont. And that's why we didn't do marriage. I don't think marriage would have passed, and then people would have ended up with nothing. But marriage raises a lot of very deep emotional issues. Look, there's two sets of issues that are a concern. One is the sort of the homophobia that's always below the surface, particularly in men. And then you got to deal with that. You just got to finally realize that the gay community is not a threat to the straight community, and really you just got to get over it. The next issue is a deeper and more complicated one, and that is the relationship of religion to the state. And that is why I think that marriage is so much more problematic than civil unions, because marriage is originally a religious concept, which became a quasi-civil and religious concept as the state began to recognize marriages. Marriages, you know, in the Middle Ages, marriage was just the church issue. The church married people. The church sanctified the relationship, and there was no state sanctification of marriage, and that's all changed. And so marriage is an incredibly difficult concept for a lot of different denominations. But I think underneath that, the homophobia, we've got to get through that, and that's where the opposition to civil rights comes from.
When you're running for office, you kind of have to come up with the official version of who you are, like your official biography, you know, with the personality characteristics and the biographical facts that you're going to really put forward to the public. And that becomes the official version of who you are. Can you talk a little bit about the process of figuring out who that official Howard Dean was going to be?
Well, that was one of the shortcomings of our campaign. I never did it. I just figured I'd go out and be who I was, and people would figure it out. And that was not true. I'm pretty spin resistant. I mean, I just basically do what I think is I ought to do, and I don't worry about the fine print. And then, you know, in presidential politics, you're supposed to spin, and you're supposed to create persona that aren't there. And, you know, everybody told me I should have talked more about myself. Well, I don't like talking about myself all that much. I like policy, and I like changing things, and I like, you know, fixing other people's problems. That's what I do in life. So I don't think we didn't as a campaign do a very good job, but I can't blame the staff for that. I was pretty resistant to doing it. So we never really did create a persona. So therefore the press got to invent one, and that did not serve us particularly well.
What do you think the difference is between the persona that the press invented for you and how you see yourself?
Oh, I think there's an enormous difference. I did not run around the country angry most of the time. I have a lot of sense of humor, which is very dry and occasionally biting. We used to have great card games in the press plane, which, of course, were off the record, mostly because of the language we used. I have a very strong sense of who I am. So stuff like the Iowa Scream speech, I didn't pay any attention to that. I figured it wasn't true, and eventually it'd blow over. It wasn't true in the sense of the way that cable networks dealt with it. And I figured I also have a huge faith that the truth will eventually come out. So I wasn't very upset about that. I didn't pay much attention to it. I laugh about it, of course. And I've seen some of the video remixes, which are really funny. I also care deeply about stuff, and I think that you did see, and I think that's helped us continue the organization after the campaign was over.
During your primary campaign, your wife wanted to continue her medical practice. She's a doctor. And she was criticized by some people for not being more visible and for not being a more active part of the campaign. Do you think that the role of the First Lady needs to be reexamined?
Actually, that was one of my big regrets in the campaign. I wish that I had asked her to come out earlier, not because I think it would have helped us, although I think it would have. But we got so many letters from American women saying, this is just great. Finally, a normal person who is going to be the First Lady or who could be the First Lady. A person who isn't dependent on her husband for her own validation or her husband's career. A person who has her own life, has her own career, loves it. You know, the reason that Judy didn't come out is because I didn't ask her until January. Now, you know, you could argue I should have earlier, but I didn't care about what the press wrote, you know, because they didn't know what they were writing or anything about the subject. But I did care enormously about the reaction that American women had to someone coming out on the press trail who's just a normal person. Judy's just a regular person. She's a very successful person. She's a physician. She's very good at what she did. And neither one of us thought that she needed to give up her career because I wanted to be president. I would not change that decision today if I had to do it all over again, but I would have asked her to come out earlier just because of what it meant to so many American women.
Were there discussions in the campaign, like, does she need a makeover? Do we need to give her a more First Lady-ish kind of haircut or, you know, different clothing?
I'm sure if there were, they were all behind my back. Nobody dare would talk like that. Nobody would dare talk like that in front of me because the answer was going to be no. I mean, we are who we are, both Judy and I. That's who we are. What you see is what you get. And we just weren't going to pretend we were something different than what we were.
So finally, you don't know if you're going back into politics or maybe medicine? Would you ever go back
into medicine
again?
I am in politics. I mean, I had a group of 600,000
right.
People called Democracy for America. We have 1,000 candidates running across the country. You know, we've actually made some good progress in trying to change both the Democratic Party and the country, even since I dropped out of the presidential race. And I expect to stay very active in politics in one way or another for a long time.
Well, Howard Dean, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Howard Dean's new book is called You Have the Power, How to Take Back Our Country and Restore Democracy in America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.